We made this.
Welcome to Academy Watch, an official We Made This podcast network show. I'm your host, Bo Nicholson. This is a podcast where you can hear the latest news from award shows and film festivals around the world, while we try and work out who will take home the Oscars on the big night. Each episode, we will also be having a closer look at one of the films which should be an awards player this season. On this episode, I'll be joined by Winter Tyson to discuss Adam McKay's Don't Look Up, a Netflix sensation and not-so-subtle jab at anyone who is a climate change denier. Listen on for my conversation with Winter, but first, here's a couple of minutes of awards news. Well, the Golden Globes have come and gone, and while many are probably correct in saying the Globes don't have the influence they once did, particularly with no opportunities for speeches in front of an international audience for any of the winners to really make an impression, I think this is still an award worth winning. After all, it surely can't hurt your chances for later in the season, right? In terms of surprises, the biggest was certainly Nicole Kidman taking out Best Actress in the Drama category for her performance in Being the Ricardos. This film has been maligned by many critics as lightweight, but in an increasingly hard-to-read category this year, Kidman may well just have her nose in front. Losing this, plus not getting a nomination in this category with the Screen Actors Guild, means Kristen Stewart winning an Oscar from here would be unprecedented. I'm still not willing to rule her out, but it is unlikely. Kidman, Jessica Chastain, Lady Gaga, and Olivia Colman appear to be firming as a top four. Can Stewart squeeze into a nomination after being the early season favourite? Will Smith won the Best Actor in the Drama category, taking his first big victory against Benedict Cumberbatch, which may see him sweep through the televised awards on the back of a strong performance in King Richard, excellent campaigning, and people just feeling like it's his time. Benedict's disappointment aside, The Power of the Dog had a strong night at the Globes, with Cody Smith-McPhee winning Best Supporting Actor, Jane Campion winning Best Director, as well as the film itself winning Best Drama, defeating its biggest opponent so far this season, Belfast. It wasn't all bad news for Belfast, with writer-director Kenneth Branagh winning Best Screenplay, beating some strong competition. That shouldn't affect Jane Campion's chances at Oscar time, as they will be in different categories, with Belfast being an original screenplay, The Power of the Dog being an adapted screenplay. Keep in mind for Belfast, though, that a screenplay win, and one of their supporting actors also winning on Oscar night, might be all it needs for a path to Best Picture, with this happening as recently as when Green Book won for Best Film of 2018. Congratulations to all the winners at the Golden Globes. The Hollywood Foreign Press Association never failed to surprise us, and they did the job once again. So now please stick around for my conversation about Don't Look Up with Winter Tyson, which, for the sake of not being confused later on, was held before the winners of the Golden Globes were announced. Stay tuned. I'm very excited to be joined by Winter Tyson, who runs the Clameur de Cinema Film Night in Guernsey, which is a part of the world that I don't know much about. Winter, very nice to have you here.
Really nice to be here. Thanks for the invite.
Just off air, Winter, you've been telling me about your part of the world, which just sounds delightful. And I'm looking at your Skype profile of you and your wife, and it looks very cold, which is not what I'm used to here in Brisbane, Australia. So if I was to visit Guernsey, would you suggest the middle of winter or maybe something a bit more kind?
No, I absolutely not. I'd suggest the middle of summer, because everyone's sat outside at the restaurants, everyone's at the beach paddleboarding, doing all that night, all the stuff we put on the tourist brochures, all happens during the summer. It's a absolutely lovely little island. But if you turn up on a great day, oh my word.
as a similar kind of recommendation, I would say stay the heck away from Australia at the moment, because we are just out of control, bad prime ministers, the whole bit. So, but today we're talking about Don't Look Up. And speaking of bad politicians, Don't Look Up is essentially a disaster movie about a comet that is headed towards Earth in 6 months, and an astrologist and his PhD candidate, played by Leonardo DiCaprio and Jennifer Lawrence, discover it, and they try and alert the authorities, and the authorities don't seem to care that much, and the media doesn't seem to care that much, and the public doesn't seem to care that much, and it is so frustrating for them as the comet hurtles closer and closer and closer to Earth. And this is a film by Adam McKay, of course, famous for making Anchorman, for making Talladega Nights, and later in his career, The Big Short, Vice, and now Don't Look Up. He seems to be taking a bit more of a slightly serious route to his satires these days. Winter, what's your opinion of Adam McKay's previous films?
Kind of mixed, really. So I like most people, I think I really enjoyed Anchorman. When it first came out, I've never seen the second one, which might tell its own tale, I suppose.
Yeah.
But I did really like The Other Guys, which is a buddy cop movie with Mark Wahlberg and Will Ferrell. I was then very excited about The Big Short, which I think is a really interesting film, because it does kind of talk about the systemic problems that, you know, went up to the financial crash 2008. But it's also, it kind of poses itself about as being about a bunch of outsiders, when it's actually about a bunch of insiders who made horrendous amounts of money out of the financial crisis, which doesn't seem to me to be the story to tell. But within it, it does have, you know, it's famous for the kind of straight to camera explanations of what's going on, how junk bonds are made, etc., and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But it came out at the same time as a film called Margin Call, which was a very kind of straight 90-minute behind the scenes at a financial firm as the world, as they realize everything's going to collapse. And I thought that was a much more interesting way of looking at sort of very similar characters. I wasn't a fan of Vice, I've got to be honest, because I kind of felt like, yeah, that's what I think about Dick Cheney.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a film that I would kind of put along something like American Hustle as being primarily about people in wigs and makeup. And I often have a hard time with films about wigs, which seem to be more about wigs and makeup and dress up.
Yeah.
So I was I've got to say, I was very excited to watch Don't Look Up, because the trailer was very zippy. We were seeing it advertised a lot at our local cinema. So there was going to be a chance maybe to watch it at the cinema. And the trailer was funny. Mm. And it was zippy, and it seemed to possess kind of the stuff I like from Adam McKay, and it seemed like it was going to be very ridiculous. And also Adam McKay's involved in Succession, which I think's probably one of my favorite TV shows from the last few years, and it's something that absolutely knows its characters. It knows how the system is what makes the characters who they are. And that is one of those programs that doesn't let anyone off the hook either.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very, but at the same time, it's very good at shifting your kind of allegiance within the character set and kind of making you see what's actually going on with these guys. And I know he's not a writer on it, and it's more Jesse Armstrong's show, but you know, he's involved with it, and I think that's important. So I've got to say, from the trailer, also from the cast, because this cast list goes miles deep as well for Don't Look Up. Obviously, you've got DiCaprio and Jennifer Lawrence as well, but also Cate Blanchett, Tyler Perry, Timothy Chalamet, Ron Perlman. Tons of people are in this film. And you're kind of like, oh, yeah, definitely, I'll go and watch that. And then you see it's a Netflix film. So, great, this is something we can watch. This is also something we can watch at home if we don't make it, you know, if it doesn't pop up at the local cinema. And it kind of had that thing of, oh, I think it was Christmas Eve it came out. Mm-hmm. Or maybe Christmas Day or Boxing Day over here. So it's like, oh, and a big movie for Christmas. Great. Yeah, well, all of those things kind of coalesced into something that I thought was quite exciting.
it sounds to me like he sort of has some credit with you, and then he loses that credit when he does something like Vice, but then he gets it back with Succession. Like, for me, it's a similar kind of tale. Like, it's like Anchorman. It's so funny. Talladega Nights, I didn't love. I don't remember much of the other guys, to be honest. I don't know if I even saw it, to be honest. I liked The Big Short. I did not like Vice. And it just, I feel like I'm going up and back with him. So when this movie comes out, I really don't know what to expect, but you're right. The trailer looks good. The cast is exemplary in terms of just on paper. Like, to the point that I almost forgot that Timothée Chalamet was in the movie until I watched it again a couple of hours ago. I've watched it twice now. Watched it a couple of hours ago, and I'm like, oh, shit, that's right. Timothée Chalamet's in this movie. I didn't know what to expect, though, because of that. But it sounds like you had reasonable expectations. Did Don't Look Up meet those expectations?
No. it's a really short answer. I mean, what gradually... So started watching it, and up until the moment, I think, when they go on the TV show, you're kind of with it. And then as soon as that trailer moment has happened, you kind of start thinking, hang on a minute, there's a lot of this. Mm-hmm. So scenes are starting to drag out. It's not as zippy as you would think from the trailer. And it also starts delving into this line of being right is the thing. So whilst, you know, you can sit there and go, I agree with what they're saying here. I agree within the context of something like climate change. I agree within the general sort of political context of what we've all been through with the various governments' responses to COVID and various institutions' responses to all these things. But I did suddenly think, hang on a minute, this is a film about being right rather than the situation in which we find ourselves. And then as they meet various characters, I'm sure we'll get into this more later, I think the level of very broad caricature starts to kind of wear you down, especially over it's just under 2 hours, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And the runtime becomes punishing at times. And the amount of, there's a lot of diversions within this film, and it's just not a fun, it just wasn't a fun experience to sit through, especially when you're being repeatedly told exactly the same piece of messaging from McKay, which is, if only these people weren't so dumb or weren't so tacky, everything would be all right. And I think that kind of, I think that sort of misses the ball. So as a viewing experience, we did find ourselves sat at home thinking, when is this going to end? And more importantly, I'm still watching it thinking, this has got to be going somewhere. And I don't think it ever really went anywhere past the setup of the original kind of the token idea at the heart of it all.
I'm struggling to think of who this movie is for in a lot of ways. Because as somebody like you who largely agrees with what Adam McKay is putting forward when he says that, you know, Dick Cheney's a piece of crap, when he says that, you know, climate change is a big fucking problem and we need to act on it. I agree with him. I totally agree with him. But I don't need to see over 2 hours of really, really blunt messaging, that I didn't find particularly funny. So I don't think the movie is for people like me and you. But I don't think it's for, say, the right side of politics, you know, like people, like, say they're like the average MAGA Donald Trump supporter. I don't think they're going to engage with this film in a way that the filmmakers would like. So I guess, can you pinpoint at all, like, who is this for?
My feeling, and like, I'm going to sort of cards on the table. I'm quite left wing. So I tend to look at things, to me, it just means I look at things from sort of a systemic point of view, rather than sort of a personal blame point of view. And I'm much more interested in kind of, you know, the problem with Trump is that he's uncouth. as far as I can see, because he's like the people around him vote in the same way. So what's the difference? So that's kind of my where my sort of politics sort of sit here. But I think this is for people who are still going on about Trump being a Russian spy. I think it's got a very kind of liberal centrist mindset to my mind, where, like I say, the prize is being correct about procedure, being correct about facts, which, yeah, you can, you know, I'm not doubting that, you know, there are a number of liberal tenets that I would say are pretty evident. However, the being right about them is not the end of the conversation. I think it's aimed at people who have kind of, I suppose the best way to say this is who've had enough of what they see as the right wing's sort of trampling of institutions and the media.
Mm.
But who ultimately, watching this film would be their activism. Like, watching this film is the be-all and end-all of itself. Because unlike The Big Short, I mean, what The Big Short has is, up its sleeve, was the ability to tell you kind of how these things went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it is very direct, straight to camera, and say, actually, look, this is the system that allows this, and this is why it allows it. Okay, great. But what we don't get in this film is anything about why this behavior is happening beyond, we can make money. And I've got to be honest, I don't think many people would object to that baseline of, oh, we can make money. Yeah, fair enough. But I think it's aimed at people who are very online and very online within kind of liberal spheres.
Mm-hmm.
Like the analogy in our country would be people who still think it, like, don't like Brexit. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't think we're going to reverse it. I think you're insane. I think that's an insane thing to grasp onto. But we still have a bunch of people we still need to reverse this thing. And I think there's probably practical ways of dealing with it that don't involve just saying, sorry, you guys were too stupid. We're going to do the grown up thing and reverse it. But even then, it's a very long film. And the one thing I do wonder is, had it been 90 minutes, would I be so annoyed at it? Probably not, because it would feel more like a disposable 90 minutes, like a self-contained disposable thing. Whereas because it's so long, you end up kind of stewing in a lot of these ideas, but there's nothing really to stew over. There's no challenge to me as someone who believes this stuff. There's no challenge to me. There's no, like, what's the call to action here? And I think because of the way the film hems itself in a way, is by having the idea be, you know, the apocalypse is coming, like, immediately, you know, it's not an abstract idea, this apocalypse in the film. Mm. So there is no answer to it. So the only thing you can do is go, we were right. And I don't know, maybe... Because I've seen a lot of positive response to it.
Yeah.
And the positive response seems to be from people who believe the same basic foundational ideas that I believe about what is right and what is wrong in the world.
Is that confirmation bias, do you think?
I think it is. I think if it was a film that was sporting of the opposite point of view, I think the same people would be annoyed at it in a structural sense. I think they'd be absolutely picking it apart.
Hmm.
But then the mission of it would be like the same film can't exist, because the only way that same film exists is as a trolling exercise to, you know, liberal tears type nonsense. I think it's for people who really like the message and aren't too bothered about the format and kind of the way that message is put together. And I'm going to be honest here, aren't too bothered about not having any kind of call to action within the film. Mm. They're happy for that. You know, don't look up is, I'm going to tweet that don't look up is, is right. Oh, aren't these people terrible? That's the activism it's encouraging, I think.
Kind of like the equivalent of changing your Facebook profile to a black just nothing in support yes. of certain film in support of certain activist movements, right? Like like yes, it's good that you support these causes. I do too. But what are we really doing, right? And I guess Adam McKay. I listened to an interview that he did with Barry Jenkins, of all people, actually, the director of Moonlight and If Beale Street Can Talk. It's a podcast for DGA, the Directors Guild of America. And so what they do is they screen the film for other directors, and then, you know, a director in the guild will interview the director of the film. So Jenkins interviewed McKay. And McKay talks about the idea of, you know, he's really realistically only hoping to really get to like 4% of people that watch this movie, like really get to them. And he talked about how an agent for one of the people that was involved in the film sent him an email the next day after seeing it, being like, wow, like you've changed my life, like amazing. And he was so thrilled to have that response. So I think there's some merit from McKay's point of view to be able to be like, look, this is my version of getting the word out there. Like, this is my version of trying to raise awareness. Like, I kind of understand that, but I don't know if he's going to get the exact reaction that he's looking for, which is people wanting to change their life in an active way. I think people might feel that way for maybe the duration of the film and maybe a couple of hours after, put it on their Twitter, like you say, and then wash their hands of it. So I'm not sure it's going to have the long-lasting effects that he hopes. But one thing I do kind of respect about what he's doing is that he's kind of swinging for the fences, I think. Like, he's making films about stuff that he cares about, and he's swinging for the fences. And I think where this film falls down, and it sounds like you largely agree, is that, like, it has a point of view. It maybe it wants to feel right more than anything. That's probably a flaw, but I think there's some other more structural flaws, like, you know, comedy that isn't actually that funny. Just some, as you say, it's two hours and 20 minutes long, and that's not inherently a bad thing. Some great movies are that length, but you're right. It does feel long to me. It does feel like there's not enough actual thrust going on here to create that length. So I guess my issue with it is less one about what it's trying to say, because as you point out, I largely agree with it. It's the way it's saying it. It's the bluntness. It's the fact that it probably won't have the effect that it wants to. So what are we doing for 2 hours and 20 minutes? Well, 2 hours and 18 minutes to be exact. I guess that's where I sort of land, that I struggle more with its technical aspects. The fact that it didn't make me feel a certain way, that it puts Leonardo DiCaprio in front of me, who seems to be trying pretty hard, but didn't move me. You know, I didn't feel anything from his character in particular. You know, I didn't find Jonah Hill as funny as I thought I was going to. I didn't find Meryl Streep effective at all. You know, just like these little things that, if they were effective, I probably would have liked the movie plenty.
Yeah, and it had it been consistently funny, I think there is a world in which it gets away with this runtime. But the reason it's not consistently funny, I think, is because it has at its core kind of like this singular idea about what the problem is. And you cannot get 2 hours and 20 minutes out of pointing at other people. I've seen some chat around things like the Tyler Perry character being sort of seen as a liberal character. And I just, like, I think there's a lot, I think people are kind of projecting a lot of their sort of feelings onto this film. And I think the problem there is, like, well, we don't see anything from him.
Yeah, there's no evidence of that at all.
Like, he's just another TV person. He's just another person from TV, and there's thousands of them. Like, what is it? What is it about this? You know, what is it about this guy? What's so interesting? What's so interesting about these characters? And I do like, you know, I think DiCaprio is okay. I mean, every actor could have been absolutely fine in that particular role. I don't think there's anything massively special, but But even with that character, it kind of, there is an arc to what happens to that character. There is a seduction of that character in all senses of the terms. But but it doesn't actually tell us. I didn't feel taken on that particular journey. And perhaps if it had singled in on that particular, just on, if it had singled more onto the DiCaprio character, kind of, you know, you're turning up, but then you get kind of seduced, and then you realize you've been seduced. You realize you've been sort of duped into a particular way of thinking and acting. But there's so much bagginess around that, that you don't even get that particular through line.
Yeah.
And there's some, I mean, there's good bit, there's good stuff in there. There's, I mean, the bit I found funniest was the whole, there's a whole kind of almost a subplot about a general who lies about the price of, like, some chocolate bars.
Yeah.
And seems to have scammed them of $10. That's quite funny.
That's hilarious.
It's so needless and apropos of nothing. but I'd gladly jettison those bits to kind of give us a straight 90 to 100 minutes following a character through this, you know, the submersion into this corporate meet from sort of the scientific academic world, submersion kind of into and out of the corporate industrial world.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of what that journey does to him. That would be more, I think that would be a smarter, kind of better film. But it is just a very baggy film. And like you say, it's not particularly, it's neither interesting nor funny enough, nor is it kind of daft enough.
Mm.
There is a sense, I know I've criticized it for being broad, but that's because I think some of the portraits are so, such basic level portraits of these types of people. But it doesn't even have kind of there's not even a daft playful vibe to the broadness, which is kind of like, if you're going to be broad, yeah, do it. Do Anchorman. You know, the reason the broadness in Anchorman works is because it's a very, like, the characters are very broad, but they're also insanely specific at the same time, which works quite like that. That contradiction within each character works brilliantly because it's not subtle, but it's incredibly specific about who the news team guys are and stuff like that. Whereas this film doesn't have that cohesion, I don't think.
It's also not bloated as hell. But let's you mentioned the fact that there is some good stuff in here. So one of the things we like to do on Academy Watch is we like to give out our personal Oscars, essentially, our personal awards. I call mine the Bobos because I'm very unoriginal. My name's Bo, the Bobos, it works. Winter, what is, I imagine, do you have an overarching kind of name for your awards, or are you going to give out specific kind of awards to this film?
I think it would be a specific type of awards for this film. It's a bit hacky, but I'm going to call it the Framboise, which is Guernsey French for raspberries. Because I think that's kind of the territory we're in here.
Yeah.
I've got two particular things. If I may, I'll start with the critical one, and then I'll end with the compliment one.
Go right ahead. Yeah, that works.
With the critical one, I call it the Swing and a Miss Award for Mark Rylance's performance.
Oh.
Mark Rylance in this film is playing a tech entrepreneur, and I can see exactly the conception for this particular performance. There is when we look at our tech entrepreneurs, there is kind of the cult side to them, the cult of Elon Musk, kind of the cult of Peter Thiel and Bezos and Zuckerberg, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But they all do have this kind of ethereal nature to them as well. When you see them on TV, they're not quite, there's something quite detached about some of these guys. And I think what Mark Rylance has done is kind of take that and absolutely throttled it to the point where I had a really hard time whenever he was on screen, because I kind of think the performance, I'm going to say possibly, very possibly, unintentionally, strays into almost a almost kind of like a parody of kind of a neurotypical personality.
I got that vibe as well. Like, I've got a lot of experience with people who are not neurotypical. I actually work as a disability support worker, so okay. And I was looking at him, especially the second time I watched it, being like, is this like, because like Elon Musk, I believe, has a form of autism, like Asperger's or something like that. Yep. So I wonder if he's, and like Mark Zuckerberg has often been, you know, spoken about in that sort of way, and I'm just like, I wonder if he's, Peter Isherwell is the character's name, I believe. Mm. If he is going for that, which would be an interesting choice.
It feels like he's picked up on that kind of that feel. And there is a detachment that these guys have. I mean, even if we're talking about like Jeff Bezos or Peter Thiel or people like that. Again, it's a problem with broadness in that it's ladled on so thickly here that there are two issues. One, is that it's kind of a ghastly thing to be in the presence of this performance. I found it, you know, it feels quite offensive. It feels, because of what the character does and how the character behaves, it feels quite othering of that personality type, which feels very, very wrong to me. Because the problem with Elon Musk is not his, you know, whether or not he's neurotypical, you know what I mean. That's not the problem with these guys. Whatever's going on.
Yeah.
But it also feels so broad that you kind of think like this guy seems on the verge of not being a functioning individual within the space in which they've been placed.
Mm-hmm.
Like I kind of felt that the problem was I don't believe this personality would be in that position. And I don't believe that personality would have that particular relationship with the Orleans family, the presidential family either.
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't feel true to the situation. But again, it's because I think there's no specificity to it. It's just, oh, if these guys are a bit like this, I'm just going to do that, but wacky. And what that comes off as very, to me, that comes off as quite derogatory.
You, in your letterbox review, you described it as a complete disgrace. You're pretty happy to stand by that?
Yeah, I think so. What I find weird is that not that an actor come up with it, because, you know, acting is playing, you know, and I mean that in a sort of a creative sense. To act is to play in a very creative way. But part of the job of directing is to kind of help mold, you know, help mold your actors' performances, help keep, you know, all the pieces on track, as it were. And that no one, I'm surprised no one in any of those scenes went, you know, this feels a bit weird. Because I'm feeling so uncomfortable watching it. I can't believe no one felt uncomfortable being in the presence of that performance. It feels a bit weird, and I think there's I think in the desire to portray these guys as other, they've actually portrayed them as other in quite an offensive way. And I do think it's quite disgraceful and distasteful. Although I will say, I think you've got to say it's an unintentional result.
Yeah.
Because I don't believe it would intentionally be there.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. I'm a bit confused about Mark Rylance generally. I loved him in Bridge of Spies. He won an Oscar for that. That was less than about 6 years ago now, I suppose. And then since then, I haven't really dug what he's been doing that I've seen, at least. I mean, he was in Dunkirk. You know, that was a pretty good movie. There was the BFG. There was Ready Player One, where he plays a very similar kind of character in a little way. It's just a bit more kind. And Don't Look Up. And they're the only ones that I've seen him in since Bridge of Spies. And I'm confused about this current trajectory of his, where he's now working with guys like Adam McKay, making maybe unintentionally offensive characters. What I'm finding confusing is, so I didn't love No Time to Die, the latest Bond film. Mm-hmm. And one big reason I didn't like it was that it was so blatantly obvious to anyone who watched it, I think, or most people that watched it, that Rami Malek's character, like, villain was not effective. Was not effective at all. The way that he played the character, the character's motivations, just all of it. I can't believe that those filmmakers didn't pull that aside, you know, and create something a bit better, because it was so obviously a sore thumb for me. I have a similar feeling about Mark Rylance in this film. Like, in a bunch of things that I don't particularly like about this movie, it would just be average and kind of not a big problem if it wasn't for this performance in particular. So I'm totally with you on that one. Big swing, big miss.
Yeah. So my other award would be sort of a diamond in the rough award, because there is one really good line in it, and I think this bleeds into kind of the succession mindset as well. And that's when Jason Orleon is, they're at a rally, the Don't Look Up rally. And this is Jason Orleon, he's the son of the president, and the very, very Oedipal son of the president. and he's, you know, he's effectively being one of the Don Jr., you know, Trump children sort of types. And he says, there are three types of American people. There are you, the working class, us, the cool rich, and then them. And I think that, make a film about that.
Yeah.
You know, I suppose Succession's that. Mm. But this idea of the cool rich, the kind of the masquerade of we're just like you sort of rich, which is, you know, which is the Trump brand. It's anyone can be me sort of rich guy.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really smart. It's a good line. Unfortunately, it's coming from a character who is, again, like an insanely broad version of, you know, the Eric and Don Jr. type Roman, Roman Roy type character.
Mm-hmm.
One review I read on Letterboxd was, how do you make this film and Roman Roy is not the president? And you kind of think, you know, that would make a lot of sense.
Connor Roy, is it?
Well, I think the review said Roman.
Okay.
But yeah, I think this is one of the problems with this film, is that Succession does exist, and kind of within the sort of the main family, the Roy family within Succession, you do have Roman Roy, who is a very particular type of, you know, he's what, you know, the cool rich that they're talking of. But Connor Roy is such a well-written character. And what you get there through the performance and the writing is a character for whom, you know, power is everything,
mm-hmm.
but is an insanely small man in his personality, in his outlook. He's a libertarian, but he's an insanely shallow person who thinks he's not. And that's what's fascinating. Whereas in this film, no one seems to have any kind of depth to them. So, you know, what Conor Roy is, Conor Roy is kind of fooling himself. Conor Roy's got a much bigger view of himself. The characters in this film don't. They just think they're cool and are allowed to get away with it. So they're validated at every step, you know. But yeah, that was one line I did think was very good, and I thought was perhaps from a smarter, better film than what we eventually got.
There's a couple of lines that I don't hate. That sort of half chuckled that I kind of half chuckled at the time from his character, particularly Jonah Hill's character. You'd be familiar that Jonah Hill improvised like a whole bunch of this movie. Like a lot of these banter with, what do they call her in the movie? Jennifer Lawrence's character. Mm-hmm. I can't remember. Kate, is it? A lot of the banter with her, very improvised. Meryl Streep apparently improvising a whole bunch of her stuff. So, like bringing that sort of Anchorman vibe to the film, you know, to try and get those lines. And sometimes you get something pretty good out of Jonah Hill because he is a good improviser. He's quite a funny dude. And then sometimes it's just kind of like, shut up. Shut up. Like, shut up. I don't want to hear this anymore. Is that pretty much all the awards you've got for this for this movie? It's a bit like that, isn't it? Like, the previous two movies we've done is Tick, Tick, Boom and The Power of the Dog, and me and my guests have had a pretty good time, like, picking out a number of things we liked about the movies. This one was a bit tricky.
Yeah, I mean, I got to say, you know, one of those I really didn't get along with, really not for me, and one of those I really liked.
Ooh.
But even the one I didn't get along with, there's a lot of interesting stuff in it. I can see exactly who it's for. And great. That's brilliant. Because not everything's for me.
Is that Tick, Tick, Boom?
This is the thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
I did not get along with it. But I can see exactly who would and what they get out of it. And I can see what it's doing and why it's been made. Mm. And so you can go, yeah, not for me. But not everything has to be. You know? Yeah. Whereas with this one... bunch of questions I can't answer on it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, who was it for, right? We've already talked about that. Mm. I found a couple of personal awards to give out. So, the Bobo for Best Score. I quite like Nicholas Britell. I've liked him in a bunch of stuff. He does the scores for Barry Jenkins films, so Moonlight, If Beale Street Could Talk. If Beale Street Could Talk particularly, I loved that score. I was so disappointed that it didn't win at the Oscars, but it was nominated. He's considered a pretty good chance of getting nominated this year too, by the way, in the Oscars. Although I don't think he stands any chance of beating Hans Zimmer for Dune, or even Johnny Greenwood in the aforementioned The Power of the Dog, or even Alexandre Desplat, who did The French Dispatch. But I really liked Nicholas Britell's work in this film. It's sort of hard to put words on it because I'm not really a big music guy, but I liked that at certain times when the movie's trying to tick along, like it's trying to ramp up this sort of urgency that's happening within the characters at the center of the film. I find that Britell's score did a really, really good job of that. And the other one, I wanted to give Jennifer Lawrence an award for acting with a capital A and trying her best with ordinary material, because I feel like she was really putting in. But like we talked about, like the characters, they have a bit to work with, and I think she does pretty well with what she has, but... like, man, like, it's just sort of hamstrung at every real big emotional turn. Like, I feel like, particularly to talk in Oscar parlance, like, when it comes to trying to get a nomination and get yourself on the big night, and they have, like, the scene that they show, you know, you need the scenes to be a genuine chance at an award. And I think her scene was that breakdown on TV fairly early in the film, like, half an hour into the film, their first TV appearance. And... I didn't feel much there, and I don't think it was her fault. I think it was the film's fault, because I found the tone a bit uneven to that point. But credit to Jennifer Lawrence where it's due. She's got no chance for an Oscar this year, but she's already got one. Don't be greedy, as far as I'm concerned. Let's talk just Oscar chances really briefly for this movie. It's actually a very strong chance for a Best Picture nomination, but not for a win. Because there's 10 films, there's going to be 10 films this year. It's almost certainly going to be in that 10. And a big reason for that, I think, is that some people love it, some people hate it. But people that like it seem to be quite passionate about it, like we talked about earlier. And one thing that we haven't mentioned yet is the fact that when this film was released, I think it was the guy that sort of came up with the story with Adam McKay, went on Twitter and was just basically... lambasting people who didn't like it as being part of the problem. And I think Netflix as the studio are going to sort of ride that campaign a little bit, sort of ride that momentum. Like, if you don't like this movie, then you must be like a red hat, like, you know, a US red hat, because you're part of the problem, because this movie's important with a capital I. What do you make of that sort of feeling? Like, because you and I are both people, I would suggest, that care about climate change and things like that. So how does it make you feel to sort of feel like they're trying to put us maybe on the on the other side of the fence that we actually don't belong on.
I think that turns people off in a similar way to the way the film would, I think, would turn people off. And the idea, if you start off by telling people they're wrong, you don't really get anywhere.
Mm.
It's like we've all got elderly relatives who were born in a different time to us, who talk in a different way to us. But what's the actual, I always think, like, what's the problem there? Is the problem the words they're using, or is the problem the mindset?
Hmm.
And chiding, what I always say is chiding people for language, chiding people for sort of their supposed assumed political views, is the best way to get people to just to disengage with stuff.
Mm.
I'd understand it if he'd said, it's not for you, as opposed to you're part of the problem. If you're already convinced, we're not talking to you. You know, if you're already convinced and find the film not funny, great, fine. It's irrelevant. It's massively irrelevant. But I can see there being a, because the Oscars does do this, and I quite like, some people say, oh, the Oscars doesn't count for anything now because blah 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 woke blah 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 whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I quite like that because I think awards shows should be pushing kind of political agendas. So I think awards and art, you know, should be at the forefront because, you know, they are for many other, you know, they are for many other things. And where, you know, if the Oscars wants to take a stand and say, look, this is nominated for Best Picture, I don't think it's got a chance of winning at all.
No.
But I would perfectly understand why it appears within that bracket and what it's doing there. And what it's doing there is a couple of things, I think. It's in recognition of the sheer depth of the sort of cast and crew.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of very talented people have worked on this film. And I think a lot of very earnest people have worked in this film. Because there is value to people who are willing to say, unfiltered, here's what I'm, you know, here's the way I see the world. I think that's great. It doesn't always translate into an interesting take or something something you even agree with, but that's fine. But there's value. There's a lot of value in those people.
Mm.
And I think I can see this being nominated for Best Picture, but not if we didn't have 10 nominees.
Yeah.
And I think there's also an industrial thing that this is a big cast for a Netflix film. This is a big, you know, this is a big release for Netflix. However, I think Power of the Dog is a better movie in a lot of ways. And I think that will actually fare better. That would be a better badge for Netflix's filmmaking credibility. I could also see this having some supporting actor nominations. I think Jennifer Lawrence, possibly. And also, I think maybe an editing nomination, but purely because there's a lot of acting and a lot of editing.
I think they're nominating, or they so what, how that works obviously is that the studio themselves, the producers, nominate like where Jennifer Lawrence will be competing. I think they've put her forward as a best actress where she doesn't stand.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right. Which means she doesn't stand a chance at all, frankly. I would be shocked if she made a top 10, let alone a top 5. Editing, you're not wrong, though. The editor's name is Hank Kerwin. He's been nominated twice previously. He worked with Adam McKay a fair bit, so he did The Big Short and Vice. Mm-hmm. Got nominated for both of those, and he won a BAFTA for Vice for editing. He's a really well-liked guy in the industry. But what is it about the editing that you think is maybe going to draw people? Because, like, at times, when it comes to editing, I don't know, like, there's, I feel like flow of the film is such an important role for the editor, and this movie dragged a lot for me, but then there is also those flashier moments, you know, like, the real, like, hey, I'm in your face with my editing moments.
Yeah.
That I think people sometimes gravitate towards, and it's why Bohemian Rhapsody won Best Editing, because that wasn't particularly strong, but it was in your face. So I wonder if you're down that line of thinking.
I mean, I, I, my line of thinking on this is exactly because the editing is very visible.
Mm.
So it's not a film where you know, I mean, even within something like No Time to Die, there were moments in that film where you didn't notice the edit, but when you thought about it afterwards, you suddenly thought, actually, that was really well done.
Mm.
That singular moment worked really well. But I think here the editing keeps, you know, it's like it's screaming at you.
Mm-hmm.
We're cutting, we're editing, we're cutting, we're editing. And like, I think Bohemian Rhapsody probably won the award for like the amount of work editing did to turn it into a film.
Yeah, I heard it was a terrible shoot.
The toil of actually producing something coherent in the edit.
Mm.
That's my take. Maybe not what happened, but that's my takeaway. But I think with this particular one, we're talking about the editing is very flashy, very visual. And I think as well, by the time we get to sort of campaigning, what people will be looking at will be, they'll have particular moments in mind as opposed to the whole.
Mm.
And I say, as the whole, I think it needs a good 40 minutes taken out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like a good, and you could easily lose 40 minutes from this film and not notice that there was missing material, because so much of it is just, you know, side alley upon side alley. We're going down, like we're diverging all over the place with this. Mm-hmm. But I think editing would be a good shout, because sort of it's well done in the moment, and that's what people will think about. And also it's dealing with, because it's quite a broad film, there's a lot of reaction in it. There's a lot of over enthusiastic kind of reactions going on. And there are scenes where we're on TV and we're we're cutting between different formats, different types of media and so on and so forth. And there's a lot of inserted material around social media posts and bits and pieces. And I think that's where it will pick it up, because when you think about how a film's edited, I think a lot of people do go for the ones that are doing the work. It's the same way that there have been acting awards in the past. Where, mm-hmm. Wow, someone's doing a lot of acting.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean it worked. It doesn't mean it works, you know?
Speaking of that, it kind of reminds me, I did not love The Revenant. I did not love Leo in The Revenant. But Leo won Best Actor for The Revenant, I think, on the strength of his career. Now, he's in this movie again. He hasn't done many movies since The Revenant. I think it's basically just Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and this. So he's been pretty quiet on the acting front. He's an outside chance of a nomination here. Like, I'd say he's maybe 5th, 6th, or 7th seed. Like, he's in that sort of territory, maybe competing with Peter Dinklage for a nomination. He's one of those names that people tend to write down on nomination ballots. So I suspect that he's got a fair chance of being nominated, not for a win, but for a nomination. Do you think it's fair that DiCaprio, do you think it's worthy that he could be nominated for this film?
This year and last year are still kind of fairly quiet years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for another fairly quiet year. Yeah, I could see it happening, but I could not see him winning an award for this. I think this is the type of film that's going to do great at... Is it the Golden Globes?
Yeah, the Golden Globes.
The Hollywood Foreign Press one.
Yeah, that's the one, yeah.
Yeah, I think this is the type of film that will go down really well there, because they can probably get a lot of the cast to turn up.
You probably would also have... because there's the drama and comedy split, you'd call this comedy. All of a sudden, it's not going up against Belfast, The Power of the Dog. It's going up against comedy musicals. So it's the biggest challenger would be West Side Story. Then Tick, Tick, Boom would be another challenger. Leo, yeah, he has been, I'm pretty sure he has been nominated for a Globe in Best Actor for this season, because those nominations came out last week. He hasn't got a chance against Andrew Garfield from Tick, Tick, Boom, but I wouldn't be shocked if they get a little bit of love at something like that. Yeah, because, and the Globes, they love a celebrity, and this film is just
definitely
full of them, right?
And it's kind of a, and I think we're sort of coming back round to some of the issues with the films, is that if you were a, like, as despicable as it makes everyone out to be, if you were the inspiration for one of these characters, I don't believe you'd, I don't believe you wouldn't crack a smile.
Oh, really?
I think there's a certain, there's a level of kind of, yeah, I'm a bit bad, aren't I? I think the film has that. And I think, you know, something like the Golden Globes, they are more, they do appear to me to be more interested in kind of the media world than the cinema world. Even though, you know, we're talking about film.
Yeah.
But I think if you have a film about a media-y type thing, a you know, that kind of second level, that kind of B celebrity level of television and so on and so forth, I think it's a film that would appeal to them because it's their world, you know, it's part of that world of it's the world of critics who are kind of personality critics.
Yeah, I can understand that. You know, actually one part that it is actually a very strong chance of getting a nomination and possibly even a win at the Oscars, and this one might seem a bit strange to you and me because we've been picking at it for a lot of this night, morning for you, is the screenplay. It's got a very, very strong chance of being nominated for screenplay. It's probably second or third seed. That's best original screenplay. McKay has been nominated in that category previously for Vice, and he won for The Big Short in adapted screenplay. So he's got a strong chance for a nomination here. I'd say the front runner is Paul Thomas Anderson for Licorice Pizza, or potentially Belfast, of course, because that's going to be a juggernaut this season. But yeah, he's right in there. And one of the weakest parts of the film for me is the screenplay, from what I can tell. So I'm a bit confused by all the love, but it's getting a little bit of attention at the precursor awards at the moment, this film.
But again, because I think there's a lot of it. The script is doing a lot, and there's plenty of it, and there's lots of words, and I think for that, like Adam McKay, he's not particularly visual, even though he plays with format. I don't see him as a particularly visual filmmaker. So the strength in his films lie more in the edit and the spoken word than they do in kind of the broader visual palette. I could see that happening, because again, it's kind of there is something about it that is a kind of a writerly exercise, and there's a lot of information in it as well. I can't see it winning. I can't see it getting really anywhere with the Oscars sort of beyond nomination stage. But again, it's also a film that positions itself as a smart film for smart people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that will appeal to people.
Yeah, and writers particularly.
Yes, and heaven forbid I suggest that people are sometimes put in nominations that they feel they should,
mm-hmm,
rather than they feel they want to.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Well, a lot of the time, Academy, there's 10,000 of them now, Academy voters, there's a lot of the time they don't see all the films, you know? So, like, Don't Look Up being something that's readily available on Netflix stars half the bloody industry. They're probably going to watch it, and they might watch it more than they watch Licorice Pizza. And then away you go. There's your nomination. There's your vote. So, who knows? The last one that has a reasonable chance at the nomination, funnily enough, Ariana Grande for Just Look Up, the song, best original song. It's probably an outside chance, fifth, sixth, seventh seed at the moment. But what do you make of that song? In the context of the film, I can understand that they're just being like, hey, look, here's some more useless activism while a comet hurtles towards us. Like, what are we doing here? But are you an Ariana Grande fan, by the way?
Not really. I'm like a 42-year-old dude who stopped listening to pop. I'm one of those people who I just about 10 years ago, I've got my bands and I'm happy with that. And I'm perfectly happy with admitting that once you stop listening to like Radio 1, you stop thinking new music exists. You know, I'm not one of those guys who's, there's never any good music. It's like, well, you stop looking for it, mate. You know, I'm fine with that. But no, I'm not. I don't have enough knowledge of Ariana Grande to really say much about her music. But what I will say is, when I was watching that scene, all I could think was, I really want to watch pop star Never Stop Stopping again. Which I think has some genuinely funny and quite pointed songs about similar themes of, you know, useless kind of celebrity activism and celebrity posing and positioning and so on and so forth. But it didn't. I've got to be honest. When you see a, I always have a big problem with stand-up comedy and pop music and original pop music within films, is that I find it very hard to believe that would exist in the sort of way that it's existing within the film, because I always think, well, it doesn't seem good enough to exist, especially stand-up comedy. And in this, and to be honest, you watch them doing the singing, you know what it's about. I can't remember anything about that song at all. But
yeah,
if you're talking about a show, if you're talking about the Oscars, I could easily see it getting a nomination, because it is an original song. It is about a thing, and you probably get her to come along and do it on the night.
She's a huge star.
Yeah, this is it. And absolutely massive star. So I could see, you know, I could see that happening. But then, you know, I've got to say, I find it hard to form an opinion. Because the problem is, I kind of got the gag. You know what the gag is, but I've got to say, I didn't really invest much attention to it. Once the gag's out there, you're kind of like, eh, all right.
Yeah, it's a gag that goes for 3 minutes longer than it needs to. Really, yeah, and it's not a strong enough song to justify it. But I do agree with your take that she's a big enough celebrity, and it's a cause song that I would suggest that, yeah, she probably will get nominated. And then suddenly you've got Billie Eilish and Ariana Grande at the same Oscars, maybe doing a performance each. Mm. You know, that's going to get eyeballs on the TV screen. You could get Van Morrison in there. He's a big star. He's also a very objectionable human being. But, you know... Yeah. Maybe he sneaks in, maybe he doesn't. Yeah, that'll be interesting to see. But that's pretty much it for the Oscars stuff. Now, I do want to peel back the spoiler label now. Okay, we're into spoilers. Let's discuss the fact that the film basically ends with it's just careening towards Earth. They are going to send up some shuttles to try and knock it off course, which is a scientifically backed method by physicists and the like. And then Mark Rylance's character, Peter Isherwood, decides that no, this is worth like $140 trillion to try and mine the stuff. So let's try and disintegrate it enough that we can manage its impact, and then we can collect the resources. You know, that's going to be really important. Obviously, it fails. The comet careens towards Earth, and it wipes out all living beings on the planet except for Jason Orlean, played by Jonah Hill, of all people. And it also doesn't wipe out his phone, as it turns out, as we find out in the post-credits scene. So, what I wanted to get into about the spoilers, for a start, we've sort of touched on this a little bit, about Leo's character and about the fact that he sort of is this really good guy. He's sort of painted as this very smart, very nice fella, has a great family, loves his family, but then he gets seduced into this world of power and influence by the Cate Blanchett character and gets drawn in closer to the president. We see that Kate starts to distance herself from him because of that, and he loses his wife because she finds him cheating with Cate Blanchett character, and he sort of reclaims his humanity at the very end of the film with the improvised line, "We really did have it all, didn't we?" And while he holds the hand of his wife and his family. What did you make of that? Were you seduced by that character arc for that character? Did you feel the emotions the film was trying to get you to feel?
No, I didn't. And so I think the, you know, that character arc and that sort of plot direction is a very well trodden arc, especially in this particular type of film. So, you look back at something like A Face in the Crowd, and you've got these. You watch a character in that film go from kind of like hayseed wisdom to this kind of populist guy, and you can see the seduction of him and those around him. You see the their seduction by the media and corporate world. Mm-hmm. But I kind of felt here it all came across as a bit flat, and I think part of the reason is, as we've mentioned before, there's too much baggage around it.
Mm-hmm.
There's too much going on around the edges of the film. I don't think any of the performances ask us to particularly empathize with the characters. I don't think there's enough going on, either in the writing or the performances, to really make us sort of cling to these guys. And part of the reason is the sort of the attitude of the film itself, which is this kind of talking down attitude that the film has. It's kind of so... I mean, I don't get kind of... If he... I never got a moment where he... There was never a turn in the road moment for me where you can see the choice... Because people don't do these things kind of blindly. People make choices at certain points. And none of the choices that were made had enough of demarcation as a fork in the road for this particular character. I liked the stuff when he was appearing in the kind of the advertising of it. But I think the problem is, what would have been more interesting, the corruption of his cause, of his cause, rather than his personality?
Mm.
Like, because someone's going to start making money off the back of saying no, look up, and they're going to start making big money. And I, like, this is part of my problem with the film, is that it assumes a very one-sided approach to... There's a very one-sided approach to corruption in this film.
Mm-hmm.
In that bad ideas are what people will ignore from corruption, as opposed to good ideas, which then dilute themselves, get diluted by corruption. I'd have just liked to have spent either more time or there to be more focus on that particular storyline, because I think it's a good one. I've got no problem with the plotting around this particular character. I think it makes sense, and if you're going to be doing this film, that's kind of what you want to do. The problem was, when he went back at the end, he wasn't markedly different from what he was at the start of the film. I didn't find, because you didn't get time with him and his family to concrete that. I mean, a lot of the time they're in disparate time zones and they're communicating via phones and chat and stuff, but you never got a sense of that family beforehand. You didn't get enough sense of it to feel that not only is there a moral cost, there's a personal family cost going on here to his actions. So when they come back together at the end, you didn't get a feel that they were coming back stronger than they were before, even in the face of this big, of this impending imminent disaster. And so I like the stepping stones. I like the image. I liked the image of them sat round holding hands at the end, but I didn't feel the film did the work to have a proper emotional payoff around that plot.
I was going to pick your brain a little bit on that, because I too found it to be a little bit... They certainly didn't come back stronger. To me, they actually came back weaker. It was like him, his tail between his legs, and he really... I feel like he was there just kind of like as a last resort almost, I mean, I guess that he probably chose to be there instead of being on the plane or whatever, but yeah, I don't know. I didn't have the emotional payoff that people are describing, in this film, like as the comet hits and the tidal waves just engulf the planet. People were talking about emotions, and apart from the score, which I've already mentioned, by Nicholas Britell, I didn't really feel it. And I was trying to articulate why that could be. And I think we've nailed it on the head a few times here, where we've talked about, you know, a bit too much baggage around the edges, a bit too much length. It's not enough to be right. We need to have a little bit more emotional attachment to the characters as well if we're going to really feel something. And I think that's where the film falls down. It's not in its morals or in its ethics, which I happen to agree with very profoundly. And not in the minor details either. I watched a video, for example, and I might just sort of digress a little bit into this, where Brian Cox, a pretty well-known physicist, sat down and talked about this movie for 14 minutes about the science involved in it. Like, you know, like, would you be able to see a comet that far away? Is that how it would have been found? Would it track this way? Would they track it using these numbers? Can it be that accurate? Would a six mile bloody wide comet cause that sort of damage? You know, all those sort of questions. And, you know, what sort of defense do we have for this? Yes, it would be to launch a nuke at it and deflect it. So he talks about how accurate the science is. Like, it's a very well-researched movie and in a lot of ways, very, very credible, according to Brian Cox. Does that matter to you?
Not really, because that still doesn't take me on the journey. So my comparison for that is something like Dunkirk, the Christopher Nolan film,
mm-hmm.
in which, you know, we're stressing the fact that these are all real boats, which is great, but that doesn't feel like that in no way bears any resemblance to Dunkirk, the apocalyptic kind of mass event that it was.
Mm-hmm.
And that kept me away from that movie. And in a similar way, here, like, yeah, I had no problem with sort of any part of this. None of it seemed improbable. Because
mm-hmm.
I suppose, because even on a most basic level, you think, well, yeah, what else are you going to do apart from, like, yeah, you'd have to shoot it out of the sky. That's how that would work. Because you're not going to drag it. You're not going to, you know. So I've got no problem with any of that stuff. Problem is, if you haven't got a human connection at the heart of that, then you're kind of lost. Because, I mean, you know, Star Wars, you can't hear explosions in space, but I care about Han Solo and Luke Skywalker and Leia and Chewie. So that works. But that works.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I get it, and I think it's an interesting... I do like the sort of, you know, you get these 15-minute delves into, you know, you get a historian on, get a scientist on, tell us about, like, how that would work in real life, because they're interesting and educational and that. But I don't think it really adds to the film's credentials, because what the film is, because this isn't a film that's positioning itself as a, like, when you watch, like, the piece itself isn't positioning itself as a scientific film. It's positioning itself as a satire.
Yes.
So you could have any science you want. And the problem is it doesn't work as a satire because it's just saying, hey, remember these guys?
Mm-hmm.
And you go, yeah. Right, remember these guys, but broader. Okay. But there's nothing – like, my problem with the film is there's not much human drama in it, or much human drama you can really kind of – invest yourself, but there's also not much satire in it, because I've seen comparisons of this film to Dr. Strangelove and Network.
Mm-hmm.
I always hate chipping in on these types of conversations because you kind of you feel a bit like the well actually film guy.
Yeah,
but
they're like top 50 greatest films ever kind of territory, those two films.
Yeah, and what those films do is they talk about institutions. And they talk about the problem at the heart of the institution, and you see through the characters how those institutions are insidious and infecting people with institutional values that go against their interests. So in Dr. Strangelove, the sort of Strategic Air Command is clearly built on a psychopathic premise, and that flows out through the people who work there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Network, the Network is like the capitalist backing of that network, as explained by Ned Beatty, like so chillingly and friendly in the film. You can see how kind of the capitalist underpinning of what they're doing there is like spoils out not only to affect the programming they're producing, but also the moral corruption to the point where there's no argument that we're going to shoot this guy on air. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? And it indicts everyone, and it indicts the systems, and it says, look, the system is the fault here. People are doing the, you know, even within network, you can look at those characters and say, I know why Robert, you know, I know why they've employed someone who's essentially a mob enforcer within the Robert Duvall character as kind of the boss at the network here. Mm-hmm. This makes sense within that sort of its take on capitalism and media. But within Don't Look Up, it's that Aaron, to me, it's the Aaron Sorkin point of view, which is, if only the dumb, all the tacky people weren't in charge, we'd be fine. But what's more interesting is, no, it's what the systems do to the virtuous and the well-meaning. Mm. That is interesting. And I don't think the film gets that across, even within the sort of the personal landscape of the DiCaprio plotline.
Yeah, and like the more interesting, like it's not enough to say, oh, like, isn't it a shame that the dum-dums are in charge? It is, mm-hmm. why are the dum-dums in charge? That's quite a deliberate thing. And it's happened over time, and it's happened, you know, over decades now. It's been developing to the point that we get the Trumps and the Scott Morrisons and the Boris Johnsons of the world. And that's a more interesting story to me. What I like about the fact that there's a clear divide between the Doctor Strange loves, the networks, and the Don't Look Ups to me. And it's like, Doctor Strangelove, network, yes, there are structural problems, there are systemic problems, but let's attack those with a surgeon's accuracy, you know? Whereas this one is just kind of like, it's like Joker. It's like, we live in a society, like, you know, great. Like, thank you for that. The system is fucked. You're right. But in saying that, you're saying everyone is fucked. And when you say that everyone is that way, I just realized I'm swearing a lot. when you say that everything is wrong, you're not actually saying anything in particular, I find. Like, anything with any sort of accuracy or potency. And, you know, while I so desperately want to agree with this movie, and I do in a lot of parts, it's just like, it's being very vague almost, which is not a criticism you can have of Strangelove or Network, to really point those two movies out. But you can be, you can raise the same criticism about Joker, you know? Like, it's just a bit like, everything's bad. All right. Like, cool.
Yeah.
Now what?
I think the comparison to Joker is spot on, because it's that sort of, it's the memification of politics.
Yeah.
And Joker in particular is a film all about individualization of politics, and this idea that, like you say, like the great revelation of, we live in a society.
Yeah. So now
and
what?
You kinda, yeah. Like, yeah, sucks to have mental illness in an underfunded system. What are you telling me about this?
Mm-hmm.
Todd? Yeah. But I think it's got that same kind of weight to it, in that it's dressed up in it's dressed up in kind of the genre clothing of, you know, of previous better films. So Joker, obviously, Taxi Driver, King of Comedy, and plenty of others. It's stealing those coats, but it's not actually doing anything with that iconography. Taxi Driver works and still works because of the way it portrays and makes us ask questions about our ideas of heroes and what's going on with lonely men.
Yes.
You know, in you know, what's going on with lonely men within this particular political setup.
Mm-hmm.
And I that's why it remains an interesting film, because it challenges you. And my problem with Don't Look Up is ultimately that it doesn't challenge me
mm-hmm.
with any of my ideas or action, but it doesn't challenge, it doesn't challenge someone on the other side. It just kind of insults them.
Right.
And I think those people need insulting. There are a group of people who need to be, like, shown for what they are in the public square. And I understand this.
Agreed,
and I'm not talking about the guys in MAGA caps who are attending the rallies. I'm talking about the guys on the stage.
Yeah.
I think there are people who need their ideas challenged. I think there are people who need to be shown up for the vapidness of what they are. But I don't think this film does it. And I even think some of those people go, yeah, baller. Great.
Look, Mara, I'm a star.
Because I would even suggest there are people like part of the smartness. I keep coming back to Succession because it's very recently aired, the third season, and part of the, you know, the genius of that show is that it seduces the viewer into their lives and then kind of keeps kicking you out again by saying it keeps pulling you up on the investment you have in the characters. And questioning why are we following these guys? I think it does it really smartly. Whereas this is just showing us the people we already know. Like, this is showing us Trump and Nigel Farage and like even the guy they've got playing the senator, who's the right wing senator on TV, looks like a Civil War ghost.
Yeah,
I mean it's the most obvious route every single time.
Yeah,
and I don't think that does anything. I would love it if this film challenged me and said, you know, if I came to this film and it said, you buy into all this stuff, don't you? Yeah, I do. And then it challenged me about what I'm doing or how I buy into it or the way I think about it. That would be really good. I'd love it if a film was challenged. I love a film to kind of challenge you and say, so what's wrong with this? Like a film like a good genre film that challenges you is Sicario.
Yeah.
It's a good genre. It's a good police film, but it also challenges the way you think about the war on drugs. And it also does challenge the way you think about kind of the militarization of police. And it forces, but by forcing you to think about how we got here and what this is doing and what these people might actually be up to, that makes it a good, and it's a good genre film, but it's also a film that makes you think about some ideas you have. Which is great, but this film doesn't do it, and I wish it did.
I like the Sicario reference because it sort of led me down a train of thought. So we talk about Sicario being, I totally agree, Denis one of the greats in the modern era, and then they made a sequel called Sicario Day of the Soldado, and they learned the wrong lessons from Sicario. Joker learned the wrong lesson from Taxi Driver and The King of Comedy and made something that was nowhere near as challenging and nowhere near as interesting. I feel like Don't Look Up learned the wrong lesson from movies like Network and Doctor Strangelove that you mentioned earlier, and also lessons from movies like Melancholia by Lars von Trier about 10 years ago, where that one was not political at all. So they're quite different movies in that sense. But what I liked about Melancholia, apart from the extraordinary first, like, 8 minutes or so, is that it really got into those emotions about what it would, like, that desperation that, or even just the leaving the desperation behind, that you feel when you're completely helpless, you know, like, giving up the fight, trying to fight, mental health, like, and really getting into those characters' minds, and Kirsten Dunst has never been better. This movie just, it didn't have the political edge of Doctor Strangelove or Network, but it wanted to. It didn't have the emotional resonance of Melancholia, but it wanted to. And it just kind of lands in the middle of nowhere. And then it has Mark Rylance, so it just goes down to a negative review for me. Is there anything burning in your pocket about this film that you need to get off your chest? Because I've pretty much run out of questions for you.
Yeah, all I can say to that is I wish there was. And I think when you mentioned Joker before, it really made me think of, like, the most disappointing thing about Joker was walking out and going, and?
Yeah.
What's the fuss?
Mm-hmm.
Was my big takeaway from Joker. And similarly here, it's kind of like, yes, and? And that's the only thought left to give on this. At the end of the day, the one problem is, yes, and is my only response to it.
Yeah, and it's like, he is trying, you know, Adam McKayla. He's trying to make films about things that he cares about, and I respect that. But, like, when it's... You can tell that he's putting passion into it, and he gets people like DiCaprio and Streep, and you know that they are all politically aligned as well. And they just come out with something that is just, like, meh. Like, the film version of the word meh for 2 hours and 20 minutes. It's disappointing is certainly a word to describe that one. And Joker was very similar for me, for sure. Winter, I've had a great time having a chat with you. We were almost at the end of the show. I have learned, indeed, that I am essentially your doppelganger. Not in looks, but certainly in film opinions, which I've, confirmation bias. We spoke about it earlier. I like hearing about all my opinions being pretty close to right, so this is good. if I wanted to hear more about what you're doing, where can I find you?
I run a film night in Guernsey. There's a website where you can buy tickets, www.cdcgsy.com. What I would say is that I'm only on Letterboxd. That's my only sort of social media vice. And so instead of saying where you can find me, all I would say is what I try to say at the end of all of these things is, if you have a local film club, please give them your support. It's a really weird time for local film and cinema clubs at the moment, both in terms of audiences not wanting to come out, understandably, mm-hmm. We get it. But a lot of these clubs are charities, or they're very tied up in supporting their community in educational ways and artistic ways. And also some of them run even on, like, to raise money for specific community charities. So I would suggest, if you're interested in film, get in touch with your local film club. They're a really good resource, not only for great movies, but a really good way to get into your kind of local film community and meet new people. And I've suggested in the past, if you don't feel like going out, but you've got a couple of spare quid or dollars or whatever, buy a ticket, even if you're not going to turn up for one of the screenings. It's every penny is really appreciated by what are essentially volunteer arts charitable organizations.
And there is such a, like, you know, I know that sometimes art and creative types can sort of come across as a little bit pretentious when they say how important art is, but I really love what it sounds like you're doing, you know, like you're finding interesting films and trying to find a community to share that with, to, further the discussion and further the art form. And when you do find a film that's got something to say and it says it well, maybe not like the film we're talking about right now, that can be a really meaningful thing. And I know personally in my life that, I mean, I live in a pretty big city, so I don't know about any film clubs here, but, you know, maybe I'll go check it out now with your recommendation, because the idea of chatting to people about films, like, that's why I do this podcast. You know, I love that sort of stuff. So it sounds really cool.
Yeah. And the other thing is, not to sound, see, this is where it starts to sound a bit pretentious, is we kind of flooded by film and TV at the moment. And what I like is, this is part of the reason I listen to a lot of podcasts about older films as well, is because you're looking for someone to kind of help lead the way, someone to do a bit of curation around, like, mm-hmm. I've got 10,000 options. What's interesting to spend my time with? And you will find that at your local film club. I mean, we're showing, our next film is Annette. The film I've got booked for March is The Seven Samurai. Oh. So it's, you know, new films, old films, and films you won't have seen in a cinema with people. And you know what the really good thing is? People who go to film clubs want to go to watch the films, not to hang out and be a pain in the auditorium and all that stuff. Yeah. So you're watching good films with good people. But yeah, check out your local film club.
I here in Brisbane, we have something called GOMA, which is the Gallery of Modern Art, and they have a Cinematheque there, and they show films, like, not digital.
Oh, lovely.
And one time Seven Samurai came around, and no intermission. They just just rocked it out for, wow, like, almost 4 hours.
Yeah.
It was brutal, but I've seen it, plenty of time, so I could leave and go to the toilet and stuff. But yeah, just magic. Like, absolute, that's a top 10 for me. I love Seven Samurai. So great choice. It sounds like you're a great curator, and heaps of respect. And the last question I want to ask you, Winter, especially given that you run a film club in Guernsey, which I'm increasingly wanting to come and visit now, if only just to come and visit your film club, have you watched anything great recently?
Yeah, I have. It's been a pretty good Christmas, actually. I've sent to, we got a couple of kids and we're watching a lot of kids' movies, so that's been good fun. But one that is definitely not a kids' movie that we watched only a couple of nights ago because it's just popped up on UK Netflix, is the Sean Durkin movie The Nest, starring Jude Law and Carrie Coon. It's a family drama. It's about a family who have been living in America. They return to the UK for financial reasons. And it's played almost as a psychological thriller. And it's a really good mood piece. It's one of those films that you can see exactly what the director's doing because they're doing it. And that's reflected on screen. And it's a really well-acted film. Absolutely absorbing. Like I say, it's just popped up on Netflix UK, and that's The Nest.
That did come across my radar, actually, but I didn't get the chance to watch it. I was curious because it had Jude Law in it, and I heard that Carrie Coon was really excellent.
She is. She's brilliant.
So, I'll take your recommendation. I see on Letterboxd you gave it 4 stars out of 5. That's good enough for me as your emotional doppelganger. Winter Tyson, thank you so much for your time. We've gone a little bit over the clock, but I've enjoyed every single minute.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thanks for the invite.
Thanks so much once again to Winter Tyson and to everyone who has tuned in. We very much hope you've enjoyed the show. If you have, please subscribe to Academy Watch and give us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, why don't you check out my other film podcast? Type Movieversaries, all one word, into your podcast search bar and give that a listen to hear about some of the greatest films in the history of cinema on a significant anniversary. Academy Watch is a proud product of the We Made This podcast network, and if you've enjoyed this, there's a good chance you'll enjoy a bunch of the other shows on the network, which you'll get a preview of in just a moment. If you want to help out our network financially, please consider supporting us on Patreon by visiting patreon.com/wemadethis. Thanks again for your company, and see you for the next installment of Academy Watch.
Elsewhere on We Made This.
Red and buried.
I think that with this podcast, we get to explore all the different types of things that exist within crime.
Yes.
And the genre, the only rule being it has to be in a book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The literary equivalent of fast food, and I love fast food.
Well, there you go, exactly.
And yeah, it's kind of a crime within a crime and a book within a book.
A murder?
A murder.
Oh!
Shipwrecked and Comatose. A Red Dwarf podcast.
And I think what it actually does is simple, silly, short and on brand and fits Red Dwarf. But critically, because it is an advert, it's actually effective. I got the message that it is a better idea to use the app technology over a phone call to the AA. And that's surely the job done, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't think it was like roll on the floor funny, but I didn't think it was unfunny. I thought Chris Barry's performance of he was ringing, it reminded me a lot of the old bank adverts you used to get where someone would be like, oh, you're with that new bank. Well, I'm with so-and-so bank and I can ring. I'm sure that there were adverts like Brian Laurie that used to do that back in the day, or Harry Enfield.
The Barclaycard adverts with Johnny England.
That's it.
Right. Yes. Yes.
Movieversaries.
How old were you when you sort of came across Mulholland Drive? You've been pretty young, I would have thought.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I watched it 2 days ago, but I haven't seen it since I was about 17 or 18.
Mm.
And I think the only reason I got into that is because I was a little film snob, but also because of the band Rammstein.
Right, they had, was it the song Rammstein in Lost Highway?
The song Rammstein was in Lost Highway, correct? But they also did a music video for some song, I can't remember what it was. But it was like a burning of a car. And I remember that I watched the making of, and they just kept talking about it being Lynchian. And I was like, what does that mean?
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.